Yeah, we can start, sure.
Okay, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Okay, let us see what we have. So we have two sessions of question and answer, the issues of the pandemic. And so now we go back, inshallah, to Quran. I noticed that we did when we, is everyone reading an ayah in English as one before that? So that's, we can become more productive. I will not go to the English anymore. Assuming that everyone has at least the translation. If there's any issue or point, there should be a bit of preparation. So we'll be more effective and productive. So we have, as we ended at the ayah, كيف تكفرون بالله وكنتم أمواتا فأحياكم ثم يميتكم ثم يحييكم ثم إليه ترجعون وهو الذي خلق لكم في الأرض جميعا ثم استوى إلى السماء فسواهن سبع سماوات وهو بكل شيء عليم. I don't think we did the ayah complete justice because the ayah say he is the one who created for everything on earth, all of it جميعا. Then he attended استوى or directed himself toward. We discussed the meaning of istawa. We discussed the istawa and this quite extensively. Or devoted himself or directed himself to the heavens, and he fashioned them seven heavens. And he is all knowing, omniscient, knowing about. He knows everything. There are some aspects which we did not. I think we discussed the issue of istawa. Because this is the old sore issue about istawa and istawa al-arsh, the word istawa. Here it's not istawa al-arsh, it's istawa ila sama, meaning attended to a sama or proceeded toward the sama. And we showed that it has nothing to do with the to space, issue of space and direction and things like that, like some people of the hadith and so on. These issues have been essentially well settled through history and through discussion. And we mentioned also that Kursi in the interpretation of Ibn Abbas and some of his students is actually the divine knowledge. And Arsh is in the best point of view, is metaphor for the kingdom. And all these ahadith about Kursi and Arsh and so on, that which describe them as they are heavenly bodies or something like that, are most likely fabricated and faulty. Despite one of them at least has been declared to be correct by Albani, but there's also a defect in his analysis. So that's this one. We have done that, I think, more than justice. But what we did not do justice is that he created everything for you on earth. We just mentioned casually this point, but it's, I think it's worth maybe one full session for it. So this ayah says again, Allah created for you everything on earth, all of it. But that's not only the Quranic evidence about that. There are another one, another ayah. Let me read it for you, which is actually a Makki ayah. It's more comprehensive. This is in Surah Al-Jathiyah, the Surah number 45, Ayah 12 and 13 says, Allahu alladhi sakhara lakum al-bahra litajri al-fulku fihi bi-amrihi wa litabtaghu min fadlihi wa la'allakum tashkurun. Allah is the one who made the sea submissive to you, sakhara lakum, subservient to you, so that the ships or the boats can run it by his permission, bi amrihi. And so that you can find some of the benefit of the bounty of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because the ships are usually the most important and most massive transportation means, even until now. It's the main transportation for huge amounts of goods and services are still the ships. Although airplanes do a bit of that, but still ships are the number one in number of size. And so that you may be appreciating and thankful to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And then it continues the ayah, then it expands more. So this is the sea, and mentioning this one aspect. But more than that, وَسَخَرَ لَكُمْ مَا فِي السَّمَوَاتِ وَمَا فِي الْأَرْضِ جَمِيعًا مِنْهَا. And he made subservient to you everything in heavens and in earth, all of it from him. إِنَّ فِي ذَلِكَ لَآيَاتٍ لِقَوْمٍ يَتَفَكَّرُونَ. So it's not only, although in the case of earth in Surah Al-Baqarah, he said, خَلَقَ, created for you. He just made it subservient. So you might say, and here is what's the most relevant, it is subservient. It's not created only for you, maybe for others, but it's definitely subservient for you, all of it, in all kinds of services, including, for example, many things in heaven, You could say, well, which kind of services does for me? What would benefit from me? Oh, it does. It does. You can observe it. You can study it. And you can understand the structure of the universe. And you can test physical theories, which you're going to test in the laboratory. It's an enormous and important service, which has become accessible nowadays. In time past, it was not accessible. For example, if a physicist present, Abdul Basit, for example, recent observations of remote galaxies and quasars, and certain radiation issues related to them has shown that, quantum gravity is not a correct theory. There are other more superior theories, for example, at least refuting some theories and taking them off the table. That's an enormous benefit in matter of understanding the universe and the physics and the nature of the universe. That's one benefit. But also the remote stars, the very remote stars, the faint ones, which pass in the middle of the sky up to a certain faintness level, they can be used using a so-called transit circle to fix the time properly. And if you go to what they call magnitude 24, that's the very faint stars, and have a transit circle device of the most advanced and sophisticated type, you can fix the time even more accurate than with atomic clocks. Indeed, so the atomic clocks can be synchronized by the movement of the stars in the vast universe. So there's plenty of services which can be deducted, things which apparently not directly accessible. But that's not what we are the issue. We are discussing about all the kind of services which can. What's important here is that this service, obviously. The mentioning that the sea specifically and the ships, which are the main transportation mean for massive goods and services across the world, as the ayah is concluding, لَعَلَّكُمْ تَشْكُرُونَ, so that you may appreciate and thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And the second ayah, that you may ponder, you may think, you may analyze. So وَتَفَكَّرُونَ, if you use your mind, use fikr, use thoughts, you think about it, you analyze, you ponder about it. So what is about to ponder? Besides what I mentioned, for example, advanced in knowledge of the universe and science and so on by these observations, but there are other things to ponder about. If this all had been made subservient to you, all of it without exception, meaning you are at liberty to use it, meaning everything in the universe is free for you. Anything for you is halal for you, unless an evidence comes that specific things have been excluded or declared to be haram. So this is the basic evidence of that, the basic ruling of entities in the universe and benefits is permissibility. You don't need to ask about, is it, for example, permissible to eat certain fruits? No need for such a question. That's a basic ruling. The question should be always, if there's anything prohibiting this specific fruit or this specific, or is it okay to juice plants or juice green bacteria or do this or do that? Perfectly permissible. Is it permissible, for example, to, since we are controlling and controlling the earth and everything is done for our benefit, is it, for example, permissible to use insecticide? Yes, until an evidence comes otherwise. For example, you are not allowed, for example, to burn ant cities using fire. That's haram. It's prohibited by certain evidence. But you can demolish them and remove them from, because if they disturb your agriculture, for example, or use another insecticide, etc., etc., with the limitation of other injunctions. So we have to get all the comprehensive injunctions about what's, for example, the wildly grown cedar tree, cedar tree, which is, what's the name of it? I think it's I don't know the English name, the cedar or cider or something like that. You can benefit anyway, but the Prophet cares anyone cutting the cedar in the countryside, the wild one, grown one, so it's excluded from benefit according to the hadith, etc. But that's not only some scholars say this, it means that all benefits and all entities in the universe are halal for you to use. But what is the meaning halal to use? Meaning the halal and haram is actually not addressing entities in themselves. An entity in themselves, we have no relation to it himself. Only my action related to entity is relevant. Like, for example, eating, demolishing, like cutting in pieces and using for building, like all of these possible, I imagine, like burning, for example. Is it permissible to take stones and mix certain stones and the various raw materials and burn them, or excluding living beings, because it's not permissible to use fire to kill living beings, but non-living beings, and burn them and extract metal from them? Yes, it's perfectly permissible, maybe desirable, etc. So it is really, when we say permissible, I mean every human activity related to that thing is permissible, including looking at it, enjoying its appearance, drawing it, all of that related to that thing is the permissibility. But also that's not the only thing which the permissibility extends to. That's not the only thing which permissibility extends to. Well, the permissibility extends to much more than that. So it is the permissibility, which says that the basic ruling about things in the universe is permissibility, but not action, like, for example, the point of view of Hizm, which is more detailed development, like of the, essentially the Shafi'i point of view, but more in articulated wording. The things and the benefits are permissible, basic ruling is permissibility. That's agreed by all scholars. This is well established by all scholars, and nobody is really in disagreement about that. That's it. But the issues of action that Hizb has adopted, as we know, that every action needs an evidence. So action have, by their own nature, they don't have any primary or preliminary ruling. They don't have a default ruling, let us say it, more in a more precise language. There's no default ruling for action. So every action, I have to search for evidence for it. It's permissible. Is it wajib? Is it desirable? Is it permissible? It's undesirable. It's haram. I have to search for it. I cannot start with saying it is according to the basic or a default ruling is permissibility. And I have to search, or someone has to search, for evidences for the other four rulings, either this is obligatory or desirable. On the other side, it is the undesirable or haram. But without any evidence coming in that, nobody offering me an evidence that, then I can assume it's permissible. That's his point of view, that it is, that's not true. That is, there's no default ruling. That's the meaning of that. Every action is for them. Every action is an evidence. What I'm saying is that all actions and an evidence has really come. First of all, actions related to items and things in the universe are covered by these two ayahs, the ayah in Surah Al-Baqarah, and this ayah, and many other ayahs in the Quran. But all other human actions are a result of human perception and thinking and in response to what we see and hear and what we think. And this is in the other ayah now, that's which we have been overlooked by Hizb and many scholars, is that, for example, there's many examples, but it shows one who seems to be refuted, is Surah An-Nahl. This again, Makki say, Wallahu akhrajukum bituni ummahatikum la ta'lamuna shay'a. Allah got you out of your of the wombs of your mothers, of the bellies of your mothers, knowing nothing, so without any knowledge, nothing. وَجَعْلَ لَكُمُ السَّمْعَ وَالْأَبْصَارَ وَالْأَفْئِدَةَ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَشْكُرُونَ. And he made for you the sam'a, hearing, these facilities, and absar and afida, so that you may become thankful. So the sam'a and absar afida has been made for us, for our benefit. This meaning, we can listen to everything, including music, including swearing and everything, until an evidence come prohibiting this listening. The same, we can look at everything. Nothing in the universe is aura until an evidence comes that you cannot look at that because it's aura. And also an injunction will come, you have to cover it because it's aura. Both sides, both covering and not looking at. And al-afida here meaning the faculty of not only pure rationalization, but also rationalization with the, what they call the action of the heart, that's for our heart, action of heart. So this is made by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for us so that we are thankful, meaning we can think about everything. We can analyze everything. We can have whatever feeling we have. All of it is open for us without any limitation, unless an evidence comes prohibiting something like that. And as a conclusion from all these three, that we can study anything, analyze everything. We come later in the Surah Al-Baqarah about witchcraft and sorcery and so on. Is it permissible to learn and analyze, just learning without applying it? When is applying prohibited and so on? And we will find that Tabari says, it is no problem in learning and teaching with wizardry and witchcraft. It's only the use may be prohibited. So Tabari is on the right track on that point. And he has various arguments of that, which will when we come with the story, the troublesome story of Harut and Marut. But let us stick to that. So these that fact that these have been created for us, that we may be appreciating, meaning we are at liberty to use them everywhere, any way we like, until an injunction comes not to use them or to not use the results resulting from them in something in some specific situation or some specific injunction. So, if you look at human actions, all of them emerge from the fact that we have some absar and afida, because all action is again mediated by the movement of the internal heart and the will, and the first of having projection what you want to do. I mean voluntary action. Non-voluntary action is not matter of discussion. The heartbeat and so on is not under our control. We are not concerned of that. But if you want to do any action, we have to go out, then you have an image in your mind. You want to do this and this and achieve this and this, or buy this and this, and then you make the decision to go. This is the action of the fu'ad. And you should be thankful that you are able to do, to be a free agent and do that. And then you can have any intention possible, unless the Sharia comes and prohibits that intention. You can't have any action possible. So no action can be excluded from all of these facilities. Then this is supported also in the book of Tawheed about the various hadith, which says clearly what Allah has prohibited in his book is prohibited. What he has allowed explicitly in his book is allowed. And what he did not address is afu. Allah did not forget. Except from Allah is afu. What does mean afu? Meaning it is void of any ruling? No, meaning it's permissible. But it is according to the basic default ruling, or it is permissible implicitly instead of explicitly. Like, for example, when the Quran says clearly, sometimes the Quran mentions permissibility explicitly, like mentioning that in the night of Ramadan, you have the permission to have intercourse and intimacy with your wives. Yeah? And all the things later, the intercourse and so on, in that night of Ramadan. That's explicitly permissible. The reason that it's most likely it has been explicitly permissible, that it was before that, in the earlier form of fasting, it was prohibited in the case that you fall asleep. The moment you fall asleep and wake up, خلاص, you cannot do anything, neither eating nor have intercourse, anything, until even no sahur, nothing. That has been abrogated, and then explicitly the word of ihlal has been mentioned there, because there was a previous prohibition. So the reason for explicitly saying uhilla lakum, it has been permitted for you, that it was prohibited before that in the previous abrogated form of fasting. But it does not take it out of the general basic ruling of permissibility. So that's I think that's an important point which we did not give consideration sufficiently, but it is a complete section, I think, in the book of Tawheed in the chapter number 3. Maybe it's number 6 in the English translation, but in Arabic number 3. That's what contains important issues of usul al-fiqh and usul and ideology. Yeah, that's the Arabic one, chapter number 3. And the various hadith there, like for example, the hadith I just mentioned, what Allah has prohibited is prohibited, what Allah has allowed is what. Whatever Allah has not addressed is afu. So accept from Allah is afu. Don't ask about it. Just do it. Just accept it. Accept it, meaning accept it as mubah. It can't be possibly wajib. It can't be possibly desirable. And it cannot be possibly disliked or haram. And also accept afu. It's not possible. There's no irrational possibility except the permissibility, which enforces again the basic ruling of permissibility. So what Allah does not address in the Quran or through the messenger is permissible. All acts. So the basic ruling of all human activities, not only things and benefits or acts related things and benefits, but also activities which are not related to any entity, like for example, thinking, like swearing, it's not related to an entity. Oh yes, you swear at a certain person, but you swear at a human being, possibly. Not you wouldn't most likely swear at a stone or something like that. It wouldn't be a matter of, but you could. Again, there may be an injunction to which dislikes that or make it prohibited, but in principle, to start with, it's permissible. There's nothing there prohibit that until Sharia comes with an injunction. So it's a basic ruling of permissibility. So this is a very fundamental, very important point, which is solves many problems, which many fuqaha try to solve by so-called qiyas. they try to do by analogy and things like that. But there's no need for that. And also there's some of them try to solve it like they call masalih al-mursala, the masalih and the benefits which has not been specifically mentioned in Sharia. They are mentioned here. These are eyes in front of you. Everything is in heaven and earth for you. Your eyesight, your hearing, and your thoughts are for you. Your mind, your heart, and your mind is created for you so that you become thankful. So it's a benefit given to all of you. Benefit, use it. That's it. So you don't need to do any qiyas there or go anywhere or call it maslaha mursala. Maslaha mursala just meaning it says something is permissible and that's it. It's permissible. You don't need to talk about masalih mursala. Masalih which is not mentioned by Sharia. It has mentioned by Sharia. It's in these two ayahs in a universal way, covering every imaginable maslaha or every imaginable benefit that it's permissible. Now, if something is permissible, then it is left to you at liberty to adopt whatever you want according to your situation. That, for example, trading in gold is permissible without any doubt. But you may be not a goldsmith. You are not skilled in that. It would be stupid to trade in gold while you are maybe an excellent builder or an excellent plumber. Stick to your business. Do that one. That's permissible. That's permissible. But you don't do that. That's a rational human being will choose the one she will visit. The same one applies to the state. When a certain permissible things are in the general permissibility, the state may choose the things which are for the public benefit, most efficient, most simple, most straightforward, and most fulfilling the needs of the people. That's obviously human consideration. It may be correct, may not correct, but there's no need to do a big fiqh there and considerable analysis about this maslaha mursala and how to justify it in Sharia. It's only justified. It's here, it's there, already there in these ayahs. Over, finish. The issue is just, is it effective? Is this halal for adopted by the state, for example, if the state adopts, for example, for traffic regulation? You can regulate the traffic, you can leave it. Now, definitely, with the advent of cars and the dangerous vehicles and so on, you have to regulate the car, otherwise the people there will be too many accidents and too many damages, and preventing damages and darar is an injection of sharia, ala darar wa darar. So how to do it, the red signal, right, green signals, this and this, it depends upon experience and human experience. It has been now well established that, for example, to use the light, the red light for stop and the green for go. It could have been reversed, but it's not a problem. Either this one is all permissible. You can use any lights, any symbols. But symbols must be used such a way that everyone understands them. There's agreement about them. They're easy to recognize, and they are not very troublesome, etc., etc. You see what I mean? So all the discussion you find sometimes that there's one source of fiqh. Is masalih mursala is just utter nonsense. It's just a fundamental ruling of basic permissibility. And the rest of it is left to rational human beings to manage their affairs according to the vast domain of permissible action. And just choose from it what fits your situation or as a state entity, what fits the situation with the injunction to be as kind to the people, as efficient, as beneficial as possible. And to restrict adoption so that the people are not restricted more than necessary. There is no need, for example, to have an every corner traffic signal. Maybe only in the main, the other places is enough to have a signal that you have to stop and watch for the traffic. That's enough. And then you know the rule, when to go or not, etc. That's all matter of practicality and what is make things as easy as possible, etc. Speed bumps, for example. It's permissible to have speed bumps. But they should not be placed unless there is a good reason for that. Because they will slow the people down. But sometimes you find that in a certain street, young people or irresponsible people are racing to having their race too much. And some accidents have already happened, so there's a damage. So you put speed bumps to slow them down by force. Especially if putting speed bumps is permissible. Because putting speed bumps just to reduce the speed is perfectly permissible. Why reduce the speed? Because those speedy guys have caused accidents and even some people have been injured or killed or incapacitated. So then you put it there. In other places you don't put it because there's no need. These people are in that area. There isn't that many accidents and irresponsible people, and there's no reason to put them, etc. That's how to judge things according to the appropriate situation. There's no need to go into major fix and so on and make it like a fundamental issue. There's no fundamental issue. The fundamental issue is settled by the Quran. That's everything in space, heavens and earth has created for you. and so that you are appreciate and you can ponder and think. And the same also applies to your own faculties, hearing, seeing, thinking, feeling. That's all open for you. So there's no need to ask, for example, a question. Is it okay if you lose someone beloved to you to grieve? This is a reaction of the heart. Most likely it will be like a reaction which is under your control. Yes. And express your grief, yes. Scream about it, no. That's niyaha. Or tore your clothing, no. That's going over the board. That's prohibited by Sharia. But any other expression is permissible. So there's no need really to go into excessive making injunctions and looking for it. Did the Sahaba do that? Did they gather, for example, after someone had passed away and read Quran? Ibn Umar did it. Ahmed Muhammad said, don't do it until someone gave him a narration that everyone was doing it. So he said, okay, go to the people, tell them to continue reading the Quran. The fact that he wanted to have an evidence from the action of the Sahaba or from even from Quran or Sunnah shows the mindset is not the correct one. There's no injunction that people cannot read Quran and send the thawab like any thawab. You can make hajj in behalf of someone. You can make dua in behalf of someone. So what prevents you from reading the Quran and meet with the family of the deceased to read Quran and lift them spiritually and share with them their grief and show brotherhood or good neighbor if you are a neighbor and so on. There's no injunction. So there shouldn't be any question. But the mindset of many of the fuqaha, including Ahmed bin Hanbal, for example, is that it seems to be that everything is prohibited until I have an evidence that's mubah. No, it's not. Or everything is bid'ah, or everything is not. That's not. He may have this specific problem and exude that it is reading the Quran after someone had is reading Quran is always good. Sending the thawab to him, like I said, maybe that's an issue which can be settled by going back to the Quran and so on. But there's nothing that you can do some good deed and ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to allocate the thawab for someone gifting the thawab. We know that it's gifting with thawab for many other things like praying, like making a hajj in behalf of someone, praying for someone. You cannot send the thawab of prayer itself, but you pray for him to be forgiven and so on. That's essentially praying for him or sending thawab for him. Or we make a sadaqah in his behalf. That's definitely well established. Yeah. So it could have not been, but it's the mindset. There's a problem. Is the mindset? The mindset is think that since we don't have a clear injunction and nobody of the Sahaba or the met in some place and read Quran, that this means that some kind of a bid'ah or something. It's not. It's not. It will be bid'ah if you say it is obligatory or it is desirable, and if you don't do it, you are sinful. Then it is a bid'ah because you are making an injunction, which is, but in the basic ruling of permissibility, and it may be socially and very desirable and bring the people together and ease on the suffering of the people who have just a loss, and experience show that it's beneficial. So the people did not get to that custom, most likely, except that by experience and showing that that's a good. And you could take even hint from the Prophet, make an injunction that if someone have a deceased in his house or something, then the people should cook for them and send for them. So the people habit now that the family cooks for the people coming is not a good habit. That should be, although it's not haram, but it's not a good habit. It's rather, you should, as a neighbor and as a relative, cook for them and then, so that they are relieved from that, because they have a calamity, they are busy with their own calamity. So that's the better stand. But the other one is still permissible. It's still not permissible. Because someone could argue, they can't cook for the people and get them, invite them. And maybe cooking for the people, maybe get their mind off the calamity. They focus on something else. So it relieves some of the pain. Still within the permissibility. I mean, you mentioned these examples which you find for some Salafi and Wahhabi get stuck with that and fight and fight left, right, and center, etc. Without getting anywhere, because the mindset, it's a problem. It's not that the evidences or not evidence the Sahaba did or Sahaba did not did. It is the mindset. It is the mindset. And the mindset is that somehow you cannot do a step. There's an obscure feeling that there's a basic ruling of whatever action humans are doing is not permissible. You have to find the evidence for that it's halal. It is not. It's halal. That's the mindset. Another mindset is that maybe something not has come from Sharia. That's another. That's you find that in the Fuqaha camp, and I have to find an analogy and find reasoning and so. It's not. You don't need that. And based on that, if the basic ruling of action and responsibility, then the basic ruling of all contracts and conditions is that they are permissible because they're human actions based on human thoughts and so on. So whatever I agree with you in a contract is permissible, unless an injunction, for example, like I agree with you, I give you 1 kilogram of gold now and receive at the end of the year 1 kilogram, 0.2. This is riba, this is haram. There's a clear injunction for that. But otherwise, whatever agreement we do is perfectly permissible. But because it's permissible and it's agreement and we have the injunction to fulfill our covenants and our contracts, then it's binding on both of us. We cannot get out of us except with agreeing to permit. So the contract cannot be changed except with the agreement of the two parties. You cannot bail out of it as long as this has been concluded correctly and doesn't contain any haram. That's it. Simple, straightforward. You don't need to go and study all these complicated things about which kind of contracts they have had at the time of Rasulullah SAW and classify them, contract this, or companies, for example, company this, like Hizb did, and got itself in a corner that this kind of company is haram, this is legal. It's not true. There's no reason for that unless you find theory in the contract and evaluation something haram. Definitely, for example, the verse prohibits bay and shart. This covers, for example, many, many sales in the West. Like you buy a house and land, and you will be surprised to find in the deed that there's the initial one who carved that out of the wilderness and took that. He made a covenant that such and such should not be done. And this in America, there are even covenants that the house that this land cannot be sold except to people of Caucasian origin. Such a shart is invalid because this contradicts the meaning of bay'ah. When I give you bay'ah, then I give you the entity and give you complete freedom and doing what it becomes your own, exactly like my own. So how come you have the right to put a covenant which will stay until Yawm al-Qiyamah, binding me? So bay'ah and shart, this is private. It's prohibited. If that would have been applied in America in time past, you would have considerable the resolution of the racial problem. But one of the main reasons for the racial problem in America, that's just to mention the wisdom of this injunction. So this year, the depth theory, and this comes from Revelation. The Prophet definitely did not think about these things, nor it came in his mind as a simple illiterate man in Mecca. No, it's not. This is from Revelation. This prohibition will exclude this door. The moment you buy a land, then you have, there may be restriction from the public hand. That land is, for example, near to a military base, should not be having this and this. This is because on the condition of military base. That's the restriction of the use of the land because of certain condition related. And this is the restriction related to the land's entity itself. So you buy it knowing this. But that other one is the will of the buyer initially to prohibit you from selling to someone else. And this is not a valid chart. That's not a valid chart. It's similar to the famous joke made about the condition of Juha. Juha once sold the house and excluded only one nail in the wall that he can use that nail. And then he was able to use the nail to knock the door all the time, say, I need to use my nail, until the people just evacuated the house and left it. They were fed up and left it. Obviously, this condition, this chart is haram. But otherwise, any other, that's for bay'ah. Because bay'ah meaning you have vacate, you withdraw your ownership and you. The same, for example, the time when there were milk yameen, a concubine, if you own a slave woman and you marry her to some man, then you have vacated your right to her body. It's out of control. She doesn't belong to you anymore. You cannot touch her in a sexual manner. You have vacated the right completely, and the right of divorce and separation is on the hand of the husband. Disregarding if the husband is free or a slave is out of it. It's not in your hand. It's out. So you cannot make a condition like this, an invalid condition, because it contradicts the meaning of marital contract. Things like that. But otherwise, all other conditions and agreements are valid. unless you find a Sharia injunction prohibiting this one, or you analyze it properly and you find it is really bay' and shart. There are examples of bay' and shart. For example, one other example of bay' and shart is like, for example, what is done, for example, by the Federal Reserve and central banks, what they call the repo agreement, repurchase. They sell. It's essentially a trick to inject liquidity in the markets. For example, they sell bonds with the agreement that they buy back at a certain price in the future. This is a clear trick to play usury. That's it. It's just a way to do it for usury. And this repo. And this is obviously by a shart. This is invalid in Islam. Cannot be done. Someone could, for example, I sell you this house. In the condition that you sell me this house, for example, the condition that you give me your house in New York with the difference of such a money. No, that is not correct. The selling is that I give you this house and retain as a price the house in New York plus certain money or minus certain money, and it's executed immediately. This will be part of the price. It's not a condition to sell that, right? That's part of the price. You vacate that one, or you do it as two different transactions. That goes, but not that in the future you will sell me that at the price or separately as a separate entity. No, it is in one contract. It's not bay'atain. This will be not bay'atain. Otherwise, it will be bay'atain fi bay'a. Two sales transaction in one sale transaction. That's prohibited. Just separate them. It's simple to separate. Value this house at a price in London and settle here in London. And then with the money, go and buy the one in New York. Or you don't want to buy it, buy something else. That's simple. You may have like a letter of intent about that, but it's not binding. Until this is settled, then you go and settle that one. Or you settle that one first and settle this one second. Each one is independent from us. This will be there. No way door back for usury and no door back for the dispute or disagreement. So otherwise, all other contracts and so on are valid. And if they are valid, they are binding. You cannot get out of it. It's as binding as the injunction of Quran and Sunnah. You cannot get out except to agreement. And the court will enforce that on you. So that's one footnote of the basic ruling of everything. Entities, actions, thoughts, is permissibility. Which will contain also all issues of contracts, etc. And this apply, for example, when the people talk about, for example, a permissible animals and non-permissible animals, etc. Every animal is permissible to eat unless the Sharia have a clear injunction. Now, this fuqaha have a disagreement about what is really strictly prohibited. Maliki say the only strictly prohibited is that what mentioned in the ayah. Because I said, إِنَّمَا حَرَّمَ عَلَيْكُمْ مَيْتَةَ وَالدَّمَ وَلَحْمَ الْخِنْزِيرِ. All this is strictly, but the other one is only disliked. So the hadith about disliking, not eating the carnivorous animals, the one with the sharp tooth and with the claws and so on for the bears, could also forbid or naha made an injunction against them. The Maliki interpretation is that it's only disliking. And some people have made a joke, let me mention the joke, said, okay, Malik Madhab is quite lenient in this area. This may be very good for the people in Korea because they're known to be eating, having dogs as delicatessen. So if we spread Islam in Korea, we should have propagated under them the Maliki Madhab to make things easier for them. That's obviously a joke. It had to be settled on Sharia ground. The Maliki point of view has a solid grounding for it. And so the grounding is that the ayah said, إِنَّمَا حَرَّمَ عَلَيْكُمْ and mentions these specific things. Except this and this mentions specific things, including pigs and so on, and doesn't mention the other things. So this is only this matter of disliking. But someone who said, this means this is what has been at the time of revelation prohibited. And the remaining things are permissible. And later on, Rasul restricted some of this permissible to a narrower field, and this is within the prophetic authority to restrict, not abrogate. You cannot abrogate the Quran except the Quran, but restrict, because he's not abrogated. He just restricted the wide permission for all animals except all foods except the one mentioned in the ayah. He narrowed it a little bit. So there's a restriction, takhsis. There's not... is not really an abrogation, which is within the prophetic authority of bayan. But someone could argue, the might could argue, they said that's the, we interpret the word nahan, is naha meaning just made an injunction of don't do could be with desirability, and then we combine that. This is just an extra that we combine the ayah and the hadith, but this is naha meaning the undesirability, not prohibition. So it's undesirable, but it's not prohibited. That's a scholarly point. People can argue about it, discuss it as much as they like. So that's one area where people could discuss, analyze, and dispute. But it's still within the framework of the fundamental principles of usul fiqh, and so within the framework of Islam. And no need to be negative about that. It's well known also that the Hanafi of India, for example, they regarded the so-called the crust sea animals as undesirable or haram. But this is definitely based on an issue related with the previous Sharia as being abrogated. This is prohibited in Judaism in the previous Sharia, and they just seems to be it has to be taken over. That has to be rejected certainly because the previous Sharia has been abrogated. In any case, all the previous Sharia has been abrogated completely. So our Sharia is completely new and fresh, even if it fits with accidentally the same injunction like previous Sharia. That's new the injunction of Sharia is a new one. The previous one was abrogated, and this one was with an injection exactly the same. Technically, the previous law which say do this and this and this, if we have the same exact do this and this, the previous one has been better with sending, with appointing Muhammad as a messenger to all mankind, it has been abrogated, even for a second. And then after that second, a new injunction has come. It has to be a new injunction. It's logically impossible to be the previous injunction continuing. That is rationally and Sharia-wise impossible, which will contradict, as I discussed in the Book of Tawheed, will contradict the universality of Sharia. Why it contradicts? Very simple. If the Sharia, previous Sharia is valid, they will contradict the universality of Islam because the previous Sharia was valid only for Bani Israel. Musa was not sent to, or maybe to Egyptian, that's all. He was not sent to the Persian or to the Indian. Certainly he was not. But some of them choose to follow and become Jewish. The Judaized, yeah, right. But he is not sent to them. He's never addressed them, nor he spoke to them. So, a Japanese could say, when a Hanafi tell him this is because it was in the previous years, Musa was not sent to me, nor to my grandparents. How can I be bound by that? The one who sent to me is Muhammad, not Musa. It will immediately create a contradiction. That's discussed more in detail in Book of Tawheed, but I just mentioned the headline. There are other reasons also that the previous Sharia is not for us, the Sharia. The same, for example, pilgrimage. Many of the rituals there are really repeating what had been in the time of Ibrahim, when the Arabs were doing it in a mutilated way. It has been cleaned by Islam, but some of it exactly the same, for example. It is a new injunction, and it became part of Hajj in Islam. Previously, it was previous Sharia. People say it was approved in our Sharia. The better and logically clean statement that it is in the previous Sharia. It has been abrogated and reinstated. The same applies with a very sore point about stoning. Stoning was reinstated again. Clearly was reinstated. It was not imported to the Sharia automatically because before that, the ayah in Surah Nisa about women locking women for life who commit adultery. Until Allah make another decision. Another decision came with the stoning, and then the stoning was an ayah in the Quran, which was this is a very complicated issue, but I mentioned just the headlines. That ayah has been abrogated and replaced by the ayah in Surah An-Nur, which is lashing 100 lashes for there's no more stoning. So, and that's where the mistake of majority of Sahaba who followed Umar in the point of view that the Prophet has stoned, that we have stoned, and this is part of the guidance. It was part of the guidance, but was abrogated because it was based on the ayah in Surah Al-Ahzab, which has been abrogated. And we have mutawatir narration proving that. Then later on, Surah An-Nur, which one of the last surahs in the Quran, according to even the narration of Aisha, and which has only the lashing, so it is universal. It's all just clearly indicated by that the married slave woman, they will be punished half of the punishment of the free married free woman. Stoning cannot be, and that's what the Fuqaha in time first got stuck with this. Stoning cannot be halved. So they halved the 150. How come you halve the punishment you support for married woman is supposed to be for the woman salat which are married? How you can halve it, halve the stoning into 50 lashes? It doesn't make any sense. Still, they many has sufficient mental disparity of logic of their mind. That they are unable to overcome. Some people, the human mind is strange. Sometimes you commit to a certain tradition which is self-introductory. For example, someone asked Sa'id ibn Musayyib, that's mentioned, it's issues of fiqh, and so I think today we just finished a few issues of fiqh, just to, for you to have a little bit of enjoyment. Let's say if, for example, a woman is injured accidentally, so she deserved dia, Or by accident, someone does an accident and then that result in a woman losing one finger. And then say 10 camels, because the Prophet said clearly injunction that for every finger is 10 camel. And then until he reach, I think, 30. But then the whole hand will be a half diya. The injunction is the whole hand is a half diya. Two hands is a full diya. Half diya. If it's four fingers, essentially the whole hand is gone. So he went down to half diya, which is not these things. And then man asked him, how come that when she has an even bigger calamity, her compensation became less? Say, this is the sunnah. What is the sunnah? Meaning the sunnah is sunnah of the Prophet? No. It never happened in the time. I mean the sunnah of Umar. So Umar was able to have this contradiction in his mind. He goes with the fingers, possibly if Sa'id Musayyib knows about this narration properly, because he was very young in the time of Umar, most likely he heard only one statement of him and so on. So maybe someone unreliable told him this ruling. It can't be. So because Umar made an injunction that the diya of the woman is half of the diya of the man. That's Umar's injunction. So he applied both, and the result then, when you go to the complete hand, you go down to half of it. How is that possible? Because if the woman diya is 50 only camels, then and the hand is half diya, it will be 25 camels. So the moment you have three fingers, you have 30 camels, so you have to go back to the half. So how come that this happens? What does this show? Instead of Sa'id Musayyib saying, oh, Umar by making the diya of the woman half of the man, made a mistake. He could not, he doesn't have the courage, or he doesn't have even the mindset to recognize this mistake. The reality is that the diya of a man and woman is the same. No difference. Absolutely no difference. And this is what can be seen from Quran and Sunnah clearly. And the same with the diya of Muslim and Kafir. It's the same. It's a compensation for a soul. It is the same. So, it's very well possible that a faqih will have a synchronicity in his mind, but he cannot overcome, that doesn't have the courage to overcome the tradition and clarify matter like I just clarified. But that doesn't matter. He's a human being. He did his ijtihad. Wrong ijtihad, it should be overcome. Still, less. Most schools are stuck with this half diya, and then a kafir is a half of Muslim, or quarter, and they go quarter and eighth, and so on. Become like a class in arithmetics to work it out. It's not. And the many hadith of Rasulullah Sallam, for example, about diya, for example, a Muslim killed a kafir by mistake, and so on. Not harbi, obviously, a kafir musalim. And then the person was going, and then the injunction was 100 camel, and he was going to, since the Muslims did not have enough in the treasury at that time, he went to Bani Qurayza or to Bani Nadir, I think, or to Bani Qaynuqa, one of the tribes, I think Bani Nadir, to ask because they are allies that they should help pitch in with some of the diya. And the hadith is there. So it's 100. Or someone outside of the domain, but he deserves a diya according to the Quran. He's not a warrior. If he was a warrior, he doesn't. Or if he's from a warrior from a hostile nation, he doesn't deserve a diya. So, it's very clear. Very, very clear. But But human mind sometimes make a mistake, makes somewhere a blunder, and then the blunder continues in focus. But that's obviously not related to the basic ruling of permissibility, but it's just how people could make some mistakes in fiqh. But we could say 70-80% of some errors in matter of fiqh of mu'amalat and fiqh of contracts and so on is going back to the mistake in understanding the basic ruling of permissibility, and also all the usul fiqh chapter about masalih mursala and so on, and is plenty of qiyas is because of this some kind of obscure feeling that you have to have evidence for permissibility. You don't have to have any evidence for whatever it is. So if someone asks about permissibility, is it allowed, for example, to pick up the nose? This question is wrong. Is there anything prohibiting or disliking pricking up the nose? That's something else. But no, that's the death. No, I'm not aware about any hadith on blowing the nose, picking up the nose. It may be not desirable, not nice. You don't like it, but does not mean it's prohibited. It may be socially not very nice. I agree with you, but it's not prohibited. Certainly not. So, or some people have some kind of obscure, dark feeling that the Sharia is not complete and it has to be filled by qiyas, which contradicts Al-Yawm Akmaltu Lakum Dinakum. Even worse, when it comes to ijma', especially if ijma' is defined the way Imam Shafi'i in a major blunder did, that the ijma' of the scholars in one generation, fi asr, at one time. And later ijma' could abrogate the previous ijma'. This is blatantly if you look at it in depth, it's a statement of kufr. Meaning, if the later ijma' can abrogate that ijma' can even abrogate Quran and Sunnah, then Islam is gone. Allah. It will be then making the ahbar and ruhban, the scholars and so on, laws beside Allah. That's finished. And then al-yawma akmaltu lakum dinakum is void, does not make any sense. And this, a great mind like Shafi'i did not see this point. So this definition of ijma' is completely absurd. Independent if it's impossible to ascertain, leave that. But philosophically, even if it's ascertainable, it's impossible. It can't be. Ijma' is just a type of over-tawathur narration, comprehensive narration, which has everyone narrates it, every scholar narrates it, so that you don't need to go and verify that it's not. That's it. It's just a type of narration. And therefore, it's only the ijma' of Sahaba which can be ever accessed by narratives and isnad. Later on, it's impossible for another ijma' later on to be unless there is a previous ijma' of Sahaba on that. And this is going back to the Prophet ﷺ for an injunction or the injunction of Quran. It means simply that there's such an understanding of a certain hukum. It's so clear and obvious that nobody will narrate anything otherwise. Everyone narrates the same. It's a form of narrative on understanding or the comprehensive and irrefutable understanding of Quran and Sunnah. Or some ayah of Quran, several ayahs, some ayahs of Sunnah, several ayahs. And mostly it is just really reporting the action. Like, for example, the Thalath Dhuhr is 4 rak'at. This is reporting the action. Everyone pray Jum'ah, pray Salat al-Dhuhr 4 rak'at, has seen from Sahaba, Sahaba saw it from the Prophet. And this was and that's the ijma' on that. It's just a more compelling narration than just tawatur, which may be tawatur for only the private and scholars know. This is that's the tawatur which everyone knows, which is called ijma'. That's it. But definitely, that's the definition of it has been essentially ijma', if it's scrutinized further. But if you go to the definition of Shafi'i, it's a complete catastrophe and calamity. It's coming again from this nagging feeling that there's many human activities has not been addressed directly by Quran and Sunnah as such. So looking for, like for example, can you, for example, shave your head? Oh no, there's evidence. But outside Hajj, just shaving, no, nobody discussed that, for example, because we know it's shaving in Hajj, so if it is done for piety, it can't be done just in normal life. Although there's some say which said that continuously shaving the head is a sign of extremism and is undesirable. Like when you speak about Khawarij, that they are shaving their heads and so on. So this shows an extreme mentality, but still permissible. although according to that is undesirable because express an extreme, it could express an extreme mentality, because those who are doing it to most likely to be more pure or more clean or more devoted, like in Hajj and things like that. And this is the sign of extremism. It's not true. In Hajj, you got shaving. Hajj is more desirable than just cutting the hair short. Yeah, no doubt about that. But does not mean that it's a sign of piety or that doing it permanently all your life is a questionable, is a big question mark. And that's the reason extremists like some Wahhabis and so on, they were, when the Beatle fashion came with the long hair, which was the long hair was the standard just a generation before in Arabia and all the Muslim world. Every man have the head or to the shoulder, and women have very long hair. That's the, but even cutting the hair for women, there's some kind of aversion. The wife of some, they always have their hair cut almost like boyish, because they were, because of the cohabitation of Prophet Islam, they needed plenty of ghusl. So it was convenient for them to have cut their hair. So they have boyish cut. But most people do not know. Say, oh, God, is like imitating the kuffar and things like that. Some of that comes obviously from not comprehensively seeing the narration and the history, but also from this mindset. Even if you don't see, if you don't have a narration, there's no injunction that woman cannot cut her hair. Yeah, it's a beauty of the woman, the hair, especially in certain tradition, like subcontinental tradition, the hair is number one beauty issue. Yeah, no doubt about that. We're not discussing that. But is it haram to cut it short like a boy? No. Unless it's done deliberately to be like a man. Imitating men, there's an injunction in Sharia. Well known, yeah, that a woman who tried to become like a man, and a man who tried to be like a woman, there's an injunction prohibiting that. A man should be a man and behave, and a woman should be a woman. There's no need for this sick mentality. It's a sick mentality. Although they have accepted that now, they call it LGBTQ, etc. But this does not make it right. It's a sick mentality. It may be rooting in some experience as childhood and some diseases and things like that. It may be or some disease in the society, but it has to be treated on the society level and the training and education level. Not by regarding it as expression of freedom and personality. It's not a correct expression. It's a bad expression. So as you see, many channels coming from this angle of not recognizing this important thing resulting in obviously in a lot of injunctions and statements you find, especially by extreme groups like Wahhabis and so on, or Ahl al-Hadith and so on. They got themselves stuck in a corner because they have this in the background somehow, the feeling that the basic there's a basic injunction somehow in the universe, this prohibition. The first, no. If you ask about anything, oh, la yajuz. No, it's not permissible. If you ask, okay, I have some bad thoughts about does Allah exist? No, that's a thought in your mind. Instead of telling you, it can happen in the mind, as long as you express these clearly, or as long as you don't ask and discuss with a scholar what does it mean, how to overcome these thoughts, for example. It's prohibited to have the thoughts. Sometimes the thoughts come even by themselves. And that's the reason the Hadith al-Aqsa said, whatever my ummah thinks and as long as they don't do and act upon, is forgiven. Because sometimes thoughts cannot be controlled. And even if they are controlled and you ponder about something, and he gives you advice for if you have certain thoughts, certain bad thoughts, how to deal with them, what would, even if he mentioned the case of someone, say, Allah created this, the criticism, who created Allah? Say, when you end to that, then say, A'udhu billahi min shaitan rajim, because it's meaning you're coming to the ultimate, and ultimate meaning, if you say, who created Allah, then who created the good, they will go in infinite regress. This is the shaitan trying to get you into an abyss of impossibilities. That's A'udhu billahi min shaitan rajim. Kick away the idea, because Allah is the creator of everything. And by necessity, he cannot be created. Finish. That's it. And asking that question, meaning you're going into infinite regress. And the best way to do it is to say, A'udhu billahi min shaitan rajim. Remind yourself that this is a satanic way of thinking, going to infinite regress. If we express it in a sophisticated language. So I'll give you the cure for that. He did not say, don't think this way. Don't ask him. No, no. If you get to that, yeah, yes. It will get there. Many people will get to that point. If you get to that point, the cure is like that. And if someone who asks you about this, then the cure is to tell him, by necessity, that that's chain of creation must end somewhere. That's somewhere, the final one. Otherwise, we go in infinite regress, which is impossible. The final one is that what we call Allah. That's it. There's nothing else there. That's it. That's the necessity. There's no further. And exciting, the question in your mind, if it comes again and again, is it the devil who is trying to get you? The devil himself knows that very well. But he's trying to get you into that, an abyss of doubt. That's it. It's a satanic inspiration. Continuously pondering about and going back and forth. You know the solution. The solution is known. Allah is the creator of everything. It cannot be created by necessity. Finish. Game over. For example, that's example. The Prophet gave the right advice, because he's obviously, the people who still think and go. So if it becomes like a habit that goes back and forth, then there's some issue there. The issue is there. It's scattered by isti'ada, by self-motivation, by psychological self-motivation. We solved that problem before. Why I'm thinking it about again? It must be the shaitan trying to get me just going nowhere, because it will go nowhere. It will end somewhere. Somewhere is Allah already. We are already there. We know that. And just for example, the Prophet will give the treatment. No, he didn't know that. He gave the right treatment. And when we saw some Sahaba arguing with Qadr, some arguing with an ayah, some with the ayah. He was very upset, and his face was red as if pomegranate has been rubbed in his face. I said, "Are you created for that? Are you ordered this? This the book of Allah does not contradict each other. It has been revealed to support each other, to testify for the truth of each other. If you don't know how to understand it, put it together properly, then leave it for the one who understands, for the knowledgeable." Instead of arguing, did Allah say that? You are striking the book of Allah, one ayah against the other ayah. There should not be an ayah and ayah. It should be put together. Put together, especially issues of Qadr, is an extremely difficult issue. You may have remembered that we mentioned some of it in the early phase. Extremely difficult. Needs considerable knowledge. And at least I say, it is impossible to be contradictory. It must be somehow be joined. I don't know the details of joining, but it must be joined, because this is the book of Allah, which has been proven to be the book of Allah on other grounds. So that cannot be contradictory. Like, for example, لِمَا شَاءَ مِنْكُمْ أَنْ يَسْتَقِيمْ مَا تَشَاءُونَ إِلَّا أَنْ شَاءَ اللَّهُ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ. The word مَشَاءَ يَشَاءَ, let me just get مِشَاءَ مَشَاءَ شَاءَ. In the case of the divine being, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the mashi'ah could be too. For a human being, you mashi'ah meaning the positive will, the will to do something. In the case of the divine being, in the Quran, is more often than not, the mashi'ah could mean permission something to happen, because he has the comprehensive control of the universe. You don't have as a human being. So when you say, this man wants this, then he wants really, and he's doing actively something to get it. There's no sense to say that he permits that to happen, because he's not in control of the universe. He's not a master of this. So attributing Mashiach in the sense of permitting something to happen to him does not make much sense. So normally it is Mashiach is the positive will. But in the case of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it could be either the positive will or it could be the negative will. Negative means that permitting something to happen, because he is the ultimate sovereign and controller of the universe. When they hear the ayah, وَلَوْ شَاءَ اللَّهُ مَقْتَتَلُوا لَكِنَّ اللَّهَ يَفْعَلُ مَا يُرِيدُ. What is the irada here? Allah does whatever he wants. This includes, permits to happen what he wants. He can permit something, things to happen, and he can positively things to happen. يَفْعَلُ مَا يُرِيدُ. So that what he permits to happen is also his fi'l, because he allowed to happen, otherwise could not have happened. So it can be attributed, as we discussed, attribution action to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And the other one is positively one. In that case, وَلَوْ شَاءَ اللَّهُ مَقْتَتَلُوا لَكِنَّ اللَّهَ يَفْعَلُ مَا يُرِيدُ, because they fought it because of themselves choosing the way of confrontation, or the way of war, or the way of confronting the messengers, whatever it is. She was talking about Allah in the Quran, that the people after the messengers, or after the messenger have come, they have disagreed and disputed, and they even up to the level of fight. If Allah would have wanted, You could have prevented that from happening, but he allowed it to happen. That's the meaning of وَلَوْ شَاءَ اللَّهُمَ اقْتَتَلُوا. If Allah wanted, he could have prevented them from fighting. He's absolute control of the universe. But Allah does whatever he wants, meaning Allah permitted that to happen, and this is his action. So these action, even if it is the direct action of these, is indirectly attributed to Allah as a, due to his permission. This is sometimes difficult for most people to put together. But even if you don't know how to put together, say, there is no contradiction. They fought with their own free will, with their own spirituality, and they're worthy of punishment on the Qiyamah, and this could not happen without Allah's permission. If you know that, this is finished. Game over, no problem. How this relates to the complication of controlling the universe and previous divine knowledge is very complex. Leave it for its due course when you meet with a scholar who knows these things, or scholars solve the problem in the future. But you know there's a solution in the back, because you know this is coming from Allah in the Quran, because you established that on other numerical evidences, evidences of the Prophet Muhammad, etc. So that's the right way of going here, because you have already established that Quran is from Allah. So this could be, which is this seems to be apparently paradoxical, at least, not as a contradiction, they must have some resolution. And the resolution is there. It's deep. It's not immediately there. The resolution is there. It's relatively, is quite deep in this one. In other issues, the resolution is very, the Book of Allah cannot have a latent open contradiction. It's not possible. And the Quran challenges. Then they ponder about the Quran. If it had been from anybody except Allah, they would be having contradiction, plenty of contradiction. Not only one or two, plenty. Actually, the Book of Allah cannot have any contradiction. But if we check any book of any human being, you will find at least one contradiction. Normally, you have many contradictions. And any book which is attributed to Allah and is tampered with, you will find contradiction. Like, for example, in the Old Testament, the various books. Even the five books they attribute to Musa, there are definitely clear contradiction there. Although they call it the Torah. The Torah is actually only what came in the tablets. So only the tablets is just a small amount of injection. It is not all these histories and stories, Genesis, etc. This is history, which have been edited, rearranged, and so on. And in this editing and rearranging of ancient scholars, some mistakes have crept in. Without necessary, maybe some even intentional mutilation has been done to cover certain points of view and certain philosophies and so on in later times. Because what we have that cannot be traced back more than 3 centuries before Christ, or 4 centuries. That's where things were collected after the Babylonic exile, based on documents, on ancient documents which have been abridged and put together. In this putting together is a scholarly endeavor. They did their best in most time, but you can't exclude that someone or some faction of the Jews having a certain political or philosophical point of view will creep something inside there. And some even the books, that's concerning the five yearly books themselves, or the Pentateuch, that's concerning that which is the core really of the Old Testament. The rest, there's generally this agreement, is just a history of Bani Israel, like kings and so on. And you'll find, obviously, a synchronization and so on. It will be obviously excessive to claim that it's divinely inspired, as it usually claimed. But even in the five books called Books of Moses, it's clearly impossible to be from Moses, all of them. And there's clear contradiction between that asynchronicity. So it's a human endeavor trying to collect all ancient books, put them together. It's okay. They did some good work, and they achieved some reasonable accuracy, especially for the from the Exodus onward. But the Genesis is just old stories and so on, maybe misunderstanding what has come from the real prophets and then put together with a bit of imagination and fixing stories and so on. That's all what you can say about Genesis. But unfortunately, Judeo-Christian tradition regard that as the fundamentalists under them regard it as infallible word of God, which is that they have all these never-ending contradictions with science, contradictions with human development, contradiction with the Quran, which will be when we come, inshallah, next time about the creation of Adam and so on, will show some of these blatant contradiction, which shows really contradiction even with biology and history. And which led obviously to mass exodus of believers out of the faith, or disregarding it as completely not binding, which is should have been from the day on. These books are not divinely inspired. They may contain some considerable good part of history, some parts of revelation here and there, some statements of the prophets here and there, but and there may be some even some secondary books which are completely fabricated and they don't fit there, etc. So going back to the fundamental point again is that the validity of the Quran coming from Al-Quran exclude really any principle of that the basic ruling of anything of action, thoughts, and so on is not permissibility. That must be the permissibility, is a basic ruling. And this is what will make the Quranic injunctions universal, valid until Yawm al-Qiyamah. That's basic ruling of permissibility, and only few things and few basic action and behaviors that has been prohibited. And then you can analyze any complex behavior, for example, any complex company. You can analyze the contract of a company, for example, analyze it bit by bit, and then recognize where if there is anything which has been prohibited. If it's set to properly without anything prohibited by Sharia, then you will get a valid company structure. And that's it. It's essentially, company is essentially an agreement between partners and so on. Some of them are very complex, some of them are very simple, and all of them are approved by Sharia unless there is a condition or a statement which is proven to be prohibited by specific injunction. But generally, all of these are permissible, and all types of companies, for example, share companies, are permissible. We don't need to go over. So that point of view that there's somehow a general prohibition of something, this nagging feeling, is that what led, for example, Hizb to claim that the share companies are haram because there's nobody there. There's no truth. There are Sharia. There's even ancient companies in Sharia where there's nobody, like Shirkat al-Wujuh. But somehow the Hizb have overlooked it. But even that, who said that it's an essential point that there will be there'll be a body there. Maybe there'll be an intellectual entity, shakhsiyya ma'nawiyya, and the other parties are contracting with this shakhsiyya ma'nawiyya, created by this contract. That's very well possible. Who said this is prohibited, creating a shakhsiyya ma'nawiyya, an entity? Like the people coming and creating an entity as like a state, a tribe with a tribal shifting and a leadership, act as a state. This shakhsiyya ma'nawiyya, created by human actor, human agreements, ultimately. There are bodies there creating it, but ultimately it persists, and it persists even after the people who created it or established it die. It continues, the state continues and having its own identity, artificial or intellectual entity. So why should be the share company be invalid on that ground? If there's another ground, fight, show it to us. That's essentially that it has nobody. There's no Sharia just that the Sharia must have a body or a contract must have a body. Contract would be between several persons establishing another entity which is an abstract entity which has its own intellectual or non-personality and identity, etc., etc. Anyway, I think but the most important thing is to hold really firm is that the basic ruling of permissibility will settle 80% of the disputed fiqh issues into the correct way, and the way which should make Islamic fiqh dynamic and more adaptable and capable of proceed in the future. And for example, because the decline of the Muslim world in the last 4 or 5 centuries, a number of constructs and contracts and companies and artificial entities have been created in the West because they have been developing, they have major industrial facilities, they have complicated structure developing, which is natural when a human civilization and way and tools of living and machinery and equipment where they develop, then certain structures of law and so will develop around them and progress further. And many things have been developed, like insurances, things like that, which are not in old Islamic fiqh. And Islamic fiqh has frozen into taqleed and just deriving from what the ancient have been said instead of going to the fundamental principle of Quran and Sunnah. With the result that then people have been got stuck. They don't know how to deal with these new contracts and so on. Plenty of these contracts and so on are invalid. They are usurious or something, definitely. Or two sales contracts in one, etc. That's definitely, it has to be exposed. But there are plenty others which are valid, which are very beneficial. And and will fulfill a good function in the society without being usurious or being the non-beneficial for someone else. So that's some of what the I entails, besides what it entails, other even things, as I mentioned earlier at the beginning, like, for example, whatever in the universe is beneficial for even just achieving knowledge and understanding how the universe works, which is also another benefit presented to humanity, because humanity is also supposed to be, human beings are supposed to be able also to think about the universe and ponder about its creation, of its meaning and where it's going, and how to synchronize that with the fundamental facts of that there's only one deity, which is the ultimate and the initial of creation. That's also part of the human endeavor on Earth. It's part of the taklif, the khalifa on Earth, being appointed successor on Earth by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which we'll be discussing, inshallah, starting next week. So all of these aspects are covered miraculously in this one ayah and supported with the other two ayahs or three ayahs, which I mentioned. And many other ayahs in the Quran have similar aspects. It's repeated in various places, giving it from various angles, but these two are enough. The one in Baqarah and the one in Jathiyah about whatever in heaven and earth created. And if there's any doubt, what's in heaven and earth, does it include ourselves and our capacities and capabilities? Yes, the ayah there in Surah An-Nahl covers that also. That we should be appreciating and thankful that we have been given hearing, seeing faculty, have given the capability of knowledge and understanding and developing thoughts, developing feeling and developing contracts and transactions and so on. That's all implicated in that. And all of that's permissible for us. Unless a specific Sharia injunction bars us from doing that. So I think that's we give that, the defined details, the technical details and the hadith and all response to all objections, etc. is in... I think it's already in the translated part in the Book of Tawheed, which is available in Amazon. I think it's already there because you have the part translated is actually chapter 1, 2, 3, which has been subdivided into 6 chapters in the translated version. But that's already out. 4, 5, 6 should be coming soon, inshallah. Will be then the second volume. Good. Sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Baraka ala nabiyyina Muhammad wa alayhi wa sahbihi wa sallam. Any question or just we?
No questions that I see. Just a second.
So we just sign off, inshallah, for next week with Allah, and then we continue with about the creation of Adam and the dialogue with the angels. And this contains a number of very deep issues. Good? Yalla.
Inshallah.
As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. See you, inshallah, next week. Same time. Bi-idhnillah. As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.